Hello and welcome to Power Play for this Friday, April 23rd. I'm Joyce Napier. Coming up on the show, how many vaccinations do we need to reopen?
There is a safe way to lift most restrictive public health measures, like certain workplaces and business closures, by this summer, if enough people get vaccinated.
Health Canada modelling shows the country can safely reopen once 75% of Canadian adults have at least one shot. So, how long will it take to get those doses? In moments, we'll bring in Procurement Minister Anita Anand. Plus, the Prime Minister gets his shot. Trudeau and his wife, Sophie, get their first AstraZeneca shots today in Ottawa, just before the National Advisory Committee on Immunization recommended opening up access to the vaccine.
NACI recommends that the AstraZeneca COVID-19 vaccine may be offered to individuals 30 years of age and older without contraindications if the individual does not wish to wait for an mRNA vaccine and the benefits outweigh the risk.
So how should Canadians make that crucial vaccine decision? We'll bring in the chair of the advisory committee, Dr. Caroline Quach. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. New federal modeling released today showed the variants of concern have gotten a foothold in the country. The variants make up more than half of the new COVID-19 cases reported in Canada. Today, BC, New Brunswick announced new travel restrictions in their province. And yesterday, the federal government announced a 30-day ban on flights from India and Pakistan. So are more restrictions in our future? Well, according to the federal modeling data, 75% of adults need to be vaccinated with a first dose and at least 20% with two before the safe lifting of some public health measures. As of 5 p.m. today, only about 27% of Canadians have received their first dose. So how do we get Canada on track to get 75% of adults vaccinated by summer? Let's find out. And joining me now is Procurement Minister Anita Anand. Minister, good afternoon. Nice to see you. Thanks for being there.
Hi, Joyce.
So let me start by asking you this. So the federal modeling shows that safe reopening can happen when 75% of Canadians will be vaccinated. I guess that's a form of herd immunity. How quickly do you think in your procurement schedule could that happen?
Well, thanks for having me on. And let me just reiterate that my area is procurement and bringing doses into the country. We plan to have between 48 to 50 million doses in this country prior to July 1st, and then 110 million doses overall prior to the end of September. We know that once the doses come into the country, the provinces then administer those doses. And so in terms of reaching herd immunity, we have to watch a number of factors, the rate of inoculation across the country, as well as the rising case counts. We are seeing variants in this country, and those also need to be taken into account. As things stand right now, Joyce, we have 11 million doses administered. We have 13.7 million doses distributed, and 27% of Canadians have received one dose at least. We are third in the G20 for the inoculations per 100 people. Those are numbers that we are continuing to build on, and we're on a very good pace across the country.
I want to change topic now and go to AstraZeneca, because there were some issues in the plant in Baltimore. So I know that much of your supply has come from that plant, and you said today that the supplier reassured you that the supply that came to Canada wasn't affected. Were you satisfied by their answer? And do you think that, you know, further investigation would have been warranted? Or were you satisfied that the supplier gave you the right answers?
Well, let me just take a step back and reiterate that most of our supply at this point comes from Pfizer. About 60% of all vaccines in the country emanate from the PERS plant in Belgium, and that's the Pfizer vaccine. In terms of the AstraZeneca vaccine that you're mentioning, the specific batch of doses from that plant was about 1.5 million doses, and we immediately spoke with the supplier and the U.S. government to ascertain whether any of the doses that we were received were affected, and we have been assured that they were not affected. And that was information that we received right away at the end of March when this issue came to light.
So we know that people over 40 are already scrambling to get AstraZeneca, and today the national the body that advises Health Canada has said we'll lower that age to 30. And a lot of 30-year-olds are going to want to take it, obviously for obvious reasons, seeing, you know, how much the variants of concern, the cases are increasing. How many more AstraZeneca vaccines are you expecting, say, in the next weeks or in the next months?
Well, let's be clear that I think many people would like to have a vaccine. I'm registered at multiple pharmacies and hoping to receive a call very shortly myself, Joyce. But in terms of AstraZeneca, we should be receiving just over 4 million AstraZeneca doses before the end of June. These doses are coming from multiple sources. Under our contract with AstraZeneca, we will be receiving 1 million doses before the end of June. We will be receiving doses from the Serum Institute as well as the COVAX facility, and we are in constant discussions with the United States for additional doses. So the supply of AstraZeneca continues to be a point of focus for us. I have been on the phone multiple times over the past 24 to 48 hours, indeed the last weeks and months, working to accelerate doses into Canada from all suppliers. And on that note, we have accelerated 28 million doses from later quarters to earlier quarters, including the months of April and May. That's why we're seeing 2 million doses coming into the country next week, Joyce, from three suppliers, and then 2 million doses a week from Pfizer over the month of May, 2.5 million over the month of June. So this is our work every day to accelerate doses from all suppliers, including AstraZeneca.
Yeah, and actually, interesting that you are actually looking ahead to next year and the following year. So if I understood correctly, 35 million Pfizer doses in 2022, another 30 million in 2023, with options to buy another 30 million. Are you preparing? I mean, you're obviously thinking ahead now, and I'm wondering, are you preparing for COVID vaccines to become sort of like flu vaccines? Is this the government expecting that COVID shots will be like flu shots have become, a yearly occurrence?
Well, let's just go back to last March when we were putting in place contracts for PPE, Joyce, and I said at that time that we needed to be prepared for any eventuality, a first, second, or third wave. And we procured 2.7 billion items of PPE, 40% of those items are contracts with dollar value, around 40% are Canadian. And I will say that we have the same philosophy in terms of our vaccine procurement. We need to be prepared for any eventuality. That's why we procured vaccines from seven different suppliers, Joyce, and that's why we put in place this contract with Pfizer that was announced today for 65 million doses over 2022 and 2023 in order to be prepared for any eventuality. Of course, we are all hopeful that the following years are not going to be a repeat of the years gone by, but we need to make sure that we are prepared, and that is the goal of PSPC and indeed myself and our government.
Anita Anand, Canada's procurement minister, keep those doses coming. Have yourself a very nice and safe weekend.
You too, Joyce. All my best. Take care.
As we were just discussing with the minister, the National Advisory Committee on Immunization has now updated its guidelines to recommend the AstraZeneca vaccine to those aged 30 and over. This comes days after provinces including Ontario, Alberta, BC, and Manitoba broke away from NACI's previous recommendations and lowered the eligibility age for the AstraZeneca vaccine from 55 to 40. A reminder, Health Canada had approved the AstraZeneca vaccine for everyone 18 and over. But the independent advisory group diverged from Health Canada and recommended the vaccine to those aged 55 and over after links to rare blood clots were raised. And today, they have lowered that age to 30 for those who don't want to wait for an mRNA vaccine. Let's find out why. And joining me now is the chair of the National Advisory Committee on Immunization, Dr. Caroline Quash. Dr. Quash, lovely to see you. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us. So you made an announcement today that was quite interesting. You lowered the age for AstraZeneca to 30. Explain why.
So what we did is we looked at the risk of being admitted because of COVID to the ICU or of dying, and we compared that to the risk of going to the ICU or dying from VIT, which is a clot complication following the AstraZeneca vaccine. And what we see actually is that in areas of moderate or high incidence, which means that, you know, with plus or minus sustained transmission of COVID, when you look at those 30 and over, you always end up having more benefits than risk. So having more ICU admissions prevented and death from COVID than having to go to the ICU because you have a VIT, so that clot complication. So that's why we lowered the age to 30. And, you know, this risk-benefit analysis, I think, was important for us to be able to reassure us and Canadians that the benefits completely outweighed the risk.
So, but you say that you lowered the age to those who don't want to wait for an mRNA vaccine, so a Pfizer or a Moderna. What do you mean by for those who don't want to wait? I mean, should anybody want to wait?
So we lowered the age to allow for provinces and territories to decide what age cutoff they were going to use. Now, in terms of the wait time, your individual risk assessment really is based on what happens out there. So if you're in an area where there's really no transmission, and if you're in an age range where you know that your COVID mRNA vaccine is going to be next week, the risk of clot or VIT is always higher than your benefit because your wait time is so short. So it really is where the benefit is all included, is in that wait period. Because from the get-go, and even this time around, NACI has reaffirmed that there was a preferential recommendation for the mRNA vaccines because mainly of their safety profile, but also because in terms of efficacy in the phase 3 trials, they had a 20% point higher protection. We all realize that in real world, the effectiveness seems to be more closely related, but at the same time, we're still waiting for this phase 3 trial from the AstraZeneca vaccine that was done in the US, on the basis of which the FDA should decide or not to authorize the vaccine to be used in the US.
That's interesting. So when you say, you know, you weigh the risks, the benefit, you tell people, well, if you're going to be in a low-risk area, first off, low-risk area today can be a very high-risk area literally 24 hours later. We know how fast the variants are moving and how fast this moves. But I'm wondering, when you say wait, how many weeks are we talking about? Is it safe to wait 2 weeks? And doesn't that kind of bring a little bit more confusion to people who are wondering, should I take this vaccine? Am I safe to take this vaccine? It seems to be, we seem to be splitting hairs here. Am I right?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. So the wait time that we looked at was between 1 and 7 weeks with the 60 to 69 waiting 1 week and the younger ones having to wait 7 weeks, weighing that against your risk of complications if you were to have COVID. And I understand that it looks complicated, but we wanted to be as transparent as possible and tell people how we came up with this recommendation. If you look around the world, everybody has done more or less the same. And a lot of countries have decided not to use the AstraZeneca just because they have access to other vaccines in quantity and because their epidemiology is a little bit different from here. If you take Australia, where their main bulk of vaccine supplies is AstraZeneca, they still decided to use the mRNA vaccine preferentially. So it's really that with the mRNA, we don't have that safety signal. So we can't just say we are putting this safety signal under the carpet and not talking about it anymore. But in terms of your individual risk perception, I think that if you're in an area where there's tons of COVID being transmitted, I would take the AstraZeneca because to me, as you said, my risk of catching it tomorrow or in a week time is much higher just because than the risk associated with the complication. But we are completely transparent and telling you exactly how we came up with this risk-benefit analysis.
I understand that. And I also understand you're in a pressure cooker and you all are very well-intentioned. I was listening to an emergency room physician, Dr. Masri, a few minutes ago, who was saying, look, there were 4 blood clots in Canada. 2 of these people never even had to go to the hospital. You know, the people at the National Advisory Committee on Immunization are not looking at the reality out there, at the devastation of these variants of concern. So, you know, just tell people to take whatever vaccine they are offered wherever they are because things change so fast. Do you agree with this doctor?
I agree that there's been 4 cases reported to, up until now in Canada, but I think that as we look to other countries, let's say the UK, where there was only 5 cases or 30 cases when they started with a rate of 1 in a million, as of today, they're now at a rate of 1 in 100 to something, 100,000 or something, with still 30% mortality. So I fully agree that COVID is devastating. And I fully agree that we should get the vaccine that is available to us. But at the same time, I don't think that we can take this complication lightly. And that's the problem with this particular situation. I would have loved not to have a safety signal. However, our systems are good. They're able to pick them up. And I'm not convinced that 2 cases never went to the hospital. I think that that might be misleading. But you still have people ending up in the ICU and dying from VIT. And that's not trivial. I mean, 25 to 40% mortality is absolutely not trivial. So, you know, we all take it from the lens we look through. So, of course, people who are in the emergency rooms in an area where COVID is being transmitted nonstop will say, take that vaccine. And I fully agree with them. That's what I'm saying. If you're in an area where it's being transmitted and where your risk of COVID is high, then take the vaccine. But you have it is an informed consent process. We can't say anything different. All vaccines have been informed consent processes. And I think it's important to say so. And this one is also applicable. You know, that's applicable to this vaccine as well.
That's good information to have, Dr. Quash. I understand how it can be a little bit confusing for some. But, you know, I'm a journalist. As much information as you can have, that's the right thing and the right way to go. Caroline Quash, thank you so much. Have yourself a lovely and safe weekend.
Thank you very much, Joyce.
And we'd love to hear your thoughts on today's show and your leaders here in Ottawa. Please reach out through social media on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and email. And coming up, North Dakota comes to Manitoba's rescue with a deal to vaccinate up to 4,000 Canadian truck drivers. Will Manitoba's vaccine deal lead to a race amongst the provinces to secure deals of their own with U.S. states? We bring in North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum next. Stay with us. And welcome back. One state and one province are tag-teaming on a cross-border vaccine initiative. North Dakota is vaccinating thousands of Manitoba truck drivers who regularly transport essential items between the regions. The program is aiming to vaccinate between 2 and 4,000 drivers from the province. Should other premiers look across the border for their own vaccine partnership? Let's find out. North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum joins me from Bismarck. Governor, welcome to Power Play. Nice to have you on the show.
Joyce, great to be with you. Thanks for having me.
You've made a few headlines here in Canada because of your deal that you made with the Manitoba Premier Brian Pallister. So you agreed to vaccinate 2,000 to 4,000 Canadian truckers that come, across your border. How did you decide that? How did you come to that decision? And will you expand it then to other workers, to other essential workers?
Well, first on the idea and the relationship, of course, North Dakota and Manitoba, we've had a long and relationship that's built on friendship and collaboration. But this specific idea, really credit goes to Premier Pallister. He called back in February and had this idea. We both are all eager. We're each other's biggest trading partners. And a lot of traffic. There's 365,000 border crossings that go from Manitoba to North Dakota. It's the fifth busiest crossing between the United States and Canada because it ties right into Interstate 29, which goes from North Dakota to Texas. And so his idea, when we started to move to a point where we had adequate vaccine supplies, North Dakota has been among the leaders of states, top of the leaderboard, so to speak, in terms of the percentage of vaccine received from the feds that we're getting into the arms of our citizens. And we're a big state geographically, small with people, 762,000 people, so less than actually live in Winnipeg. But it's in an area that's the size of all six New England states. But we've got over 550,000 vaccines delivered. So we said, hey, moving into the space where we've got vaccine. How can we help our neighbors? And that's where Brian's idea was a great one. We launched it this week, and we're off to a great start as these truck drivers returning to Canada on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday pull into a safety rest area off the interstate, get their vaccine right there, and then proceed across the border. And we've even had one snowbird coming back to from Arizona to Winnipeg that we were happy to vaccinate.
Oh, well, and I know that Saskatchewan Premier Scott Moe is looking for a similar arrangement. So I know you're in talks with him.
Yeah, we spoke with Premier Moe on Monday, and also another great relationship. Our border with Canada, 310 miles long, about two-thirds, that's Manitoba, one-third Saskatchewan. In the western part of the state, where we've big energy-producing region. We've got a lot of energy workers in addition to ag workers going back and forth. And so we're speaking with Premier Moe again on Monday, and I expect that we'll get a similar project rolling between North Dakota and Saskatchewan.
That's interesting. You just told me that you vaccinated a snowbird, which, not a trucker, obviously not a truck driver. How did that happen?
Well, they heard about it. They pulled in. They were returning to Canada. And we've got vaccine. We want to get it into the arms of people that are returning. And so happy to do that.
So you say you have, I read a few interviews that you granted, that you have a healthy vaccine supply. So is this because you have extra vaccine that you're starting to give it away to essential workers? Understand totally the reasoning, but do you have a lot of them in your fridges? Do you have a lot of extra vaccines?
Well, I wouldn't say we have a lot of extra, but we're at that inflection point where we've been utilizing every week since the vaccine program started flowing back in December. But we were getting 100% of what we were receiving out and into people's arms. Now that we're at that point where we're moving from rationing, if you will, to marketing, because right now it's available in North Dakota to anybody who's 16 and over, and we're starting to see a slowdown in demand. And so with that, then we said, let's reach out to our neighbors, collaborate with our neighbors, and make sure that we can, again, in this case, get this important border open. Over $6 billion of trade going back and forth between North Dakota and Canada. And we want to, again, it's taking care of our neighbors is just good business.
And do you think other premiers and other governors should come to the same sort of arrangement because there's a lot of cross-border trade in other states and in other provinces? Should that happen along the border?
Well, I think, again, each governor will have to make their own decisions, but I was on a call earlier this week, and I know the governors from Montana and New Hampshire are on that call. They're both also probably in similar situations. I know New Hampshire's done a great job at getting a lot of vaccinations out. And so I think we'll maybe see more of these ideas take off along the border, because again, we want to not only save lives, but we also want to save livelihoods, and getting trade open between these two, two of the most important trading partner countries in the world, Canada and the United States. I mean, that's really essential to so many people, and especially those of us live in northern tier states.
I listen to you and I tell myself other premiers should get on the phone with other governors to do the same thing. Now, you are doing this for truck drivers that, you know, take stuff across the border. Are you thinking of doing this for instance, essential workers or for other Canadians that need to come across, or even tourists that come across the border?
Well, we've started to have that conversation. We said, let's get through this pilot with the essential workers, focused on those that, as part of their job, are coming into the United States. Sometimes they're here doing, they might be coming on a Monday or Tuesday, be in the U.S. for 2 or 3 days. We're trying to catch them when they're returning on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. When we opened this up on Wednesday at the safety rest area just below the border, we were going to open from noon till 8 p.m. On those days, we had 15 people in line at 11 a.m. an hour early. So we started vaccinating early. We opened early yesterday, opened early today. So it's fun to see the response, fun to hear from truck drivers who feel like this is a real gift to them, because obviously they're at risk when they're driving around and having the contact they're having. So again, happy to help out with these essential workers.
North Dakota Governor Doug Burgum, what a great initiative. Thanks so much for taking the time to tell us about it. And before we head to break, here's some other news you need to know. Bombshell testimony at the Status of Women House Committee from Major Kelly Brennan about her relationship with Canada's former top soldier. General Jonathan Vance is under both parliamentary and military investigations over allegations he engaged in an inappropriate sexual relationship with a woman under his command. Brennan testified before the parliamentary committee that Vance ordered her to lie about their relationship, otherwise there would be consequences, and that he fathered 2 children with her.
In my experience, in many different areas, the law does not apply to him. He doesn't, on a personal note, he fathered 2 children with me. He's not responsible to pay or to have those children under his responsibility. It's all up to me. So he's excluded himself from a lot of portions of the Canadian society that we hold as responsible.
Brennan also says she doesn't think she'll get justice. Vance did not respond to CTV's request for comment, but he previously denied the allegations against him. And restrictions are now in place in British Columbia, limiting people to travel only within their own health region. The province says it's relying on BC ferries and tourism leaders to help restrict non-essential trips. BC Solicitor General says he's working with police on how the restrictions will be enforced, but the setup will be similar to how drivers are stopped for impaired driving. And the welcome mat is being removed in New Brunswick. Premier Blaine Higgs says the province doesn't want visitors right now, given the current status of COVID-19, and that the end they're bringing in stronger travel restrictions.
Effective at 11:59 p.m. on Saturday, all leisure and non-essential travelers, every person approved to move to New Brunswick, and all business travelers who are not rotational workers, truckers, or commuters will be required to isolate for at least the first 7 days of their 14-day isolation in an isolation hotel at their own expense. This rule applies regardless of whether or not the traveler has been vaccinated. Isolation hotels will be located in Fredericton, St. John, Moncton, Miramichi, Bathurst, Campbellton, and Woodstock.
Higgs says the estimated cost per night will be around $200. The measure is expected to last until the end of May. And Canadians Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor have been detained in China for 865 days. On Wednesday, a BC court granted Huawei executive Meng Wanzhou request to delay her extradition hearing until August. Wangzhou's defense team requested an adjournment to review banking documents released by a Hong Kong court, which say they could help her fight her extradition to the U.S. The arrests of Kovrig and Spavor are widely seen as an act of retaliation for Canada's arrest of the Huawei executive. And coming up is a brighter summer in Canada's future. New federal modeling suggests restrictions can ease if enough people are vaccinated. Can the province handle the timeline? Our Friday panel of strategists and insiders will weigh in. Stay with PowerPlay. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Is Canada finally nearing the light at the end of the COVID-19 tunnel? Federal modeling offers that glimpse of hope. The numbers say if 75% of the population has received their first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, Canada's strictest measures could be lifted this summer without fear of flooding hospitals. This may look promising on paper, but will it come down to provinces? How will they roll out their vaccines? Can they keep up? Let's put it to the strategists. Greg McCachran from Proof Strategies leans liberal. The Toronto Sun's editor-in-chief, Adrian Batra, offers a conservative perspective. Anne McGrath is the NDP's national director. And Greg Weston from Earnscliff Strategy Group has a nonpartisan point of view. We like to call him our Switzerland strategist. Happy Friday. Nice to see you. We've got a lot of stuff to go through. So I want to start with you, Greg McCachran, because I want to know, yesterday, the Ottawa decided to ban flights from India and Pakistan. Too little, too late? Is this just a political move? Is this going to help? What does this look like from your vantage point?
Well, I think context is very key, and we've lost context in a lot of the discussions during the pandemic. It feels like sometimes only one story at a time can be talked about and then only part of that story. But obviously there is a concern. That's why the government is reacting. I think we can take a look at how quickly they reacted and whether or not that was sufficient. But it was Kevin Gallagher, one of your reporters, who tweeted the other day about the comparison of the number of cases on international flights and then the cases on domestic flights and whether or not we need to address that. I think the bigger picture here is the variants. And we seem to be like generals fighting the last battle. We weren't ready for this. We saw signs of the variants. I think, in the public consciousness by January, I think government saw these in December. I think that's what we needed to kind of really, really press down upon. And I'm not sure that we did it, but the government has acted now. I think the other thing is we need to look at the amount of variants that have come in from not India, but from the United States. That may be a concern as well.
Adrian, I know the Premier of Ontario had asked the federal government to do this, a while back, saying, listen, Toronto, Pearson is in Toronto. People come out of that airport, get into the big Canada's biggest city, and then that's the way it spreads. He's had a pretty bad week. How does he recover from that week?
Well, yes, Premier Ford has had a rough few weeks, I think. To his credit, he came out the other day and apologized for overstepping and, reiterated that they've been working very hard. And no question, everybody knows how hard every politician is stretched and tired and staff are exhausted and all those things. But it doesn't still discount the notion of some of the policies that they tried to implement and very quickly and swiftly, to their credit, turned it around in 24 hours. But with respect to this whole notion of whether or not we shut these flights down soon enough, I think the answer is no. In fact, I would say to you, Joyce, that it was the mayor of Brampton, Patrick Brown, who said yesterday very clearly and plainly, just shut the airport. And so I think how we handle this, yes, is going to matter, you know, what the provinces do specifically on the vaccine rollout. But on this issue of the border, there's too many stories that we are now reporting where even those that are arriving, regardless of where it's from, if it's, as Greg said, the United States or Brazil or India or wherever, they're not isolating. They're not following the rules. And so that is fundamentally problematic when you have someone who's got living with six or seven people who may test positive for COVID 5 or 6 days after they land and no one's checking, there's how you get those spreads like we saw in the modeling today.
And I'm curious because New Brunswick Premier Blaine Higgs announced today some pretty strict restrictions, some of which the Premier of Ontario got in trouble for. You know, he is cracking down in BC as well. You know, that seems to be happening a little bit across the country. Will they get as much heat as the Premier of Ontario?
Well, first let me say that, Joyce, that I'm going to be a little bit boring here and say that I find myself on pretty well the same page as both Adrian and Greg on this. I think that there should
be... No, that's good.
I think that there should be restrictions, border restrictions, from particularly from hotspot areas, but really, even a little bit more broadly than that. I think that people are very concerned about the variants and about the ability of people to not respect some of the restrictions that are there. So I think that there do have to be restrictions, and I think they have to be fairly strict and probably maybe even a little bit more broad than they have been so far. With respect to Premier Ford and what happened with him, I think part of it is that he talks a lot about listening to the public health advice, but clearly wasn't either didn't hear it or whatever, because what he announced was not consistent with what the public health officials were saying. And I think that that's where he really got into trouble. It was like a complete disconnect. And it was so obviously the wrong thing to do. And it's true, he has turned it around, but I think he suffered some significant damage, and I'm not sure it's recoverable. And I think that the difference with other areas is that his was just so obviously not in touch with what the public health advice was.
Yeah, and I want to ask you, Greg Weston, you know, about political prices to pay. We know that Doug Ford is paying a political price. You just have to go on Twitter to see that. But you know, in closing borders with India, for instance, and Pakistan, is there a political price to pay? How does that work? Do those countries understand why countries close their border to them?
I think India and Pakistan right now are in such a crisis, Joyce, they would totally understand why that has to happen. It doesn't help them at all to have citizens of those countries going around the world, possibly spreading the pandemic. So it's not as though it's been shut down completely. And by the way, for Mayor Brown, who wanted to close down the airport, we have millions of doses of vaccines arriving there. He may want to rethink that strategy a little bit. I mean, the fact is that no matter how much we try to contain this to 99% of Canadians, you simply can't explain why you wouldn't stop flights coming in when they have people who are have COVID, are testing positive with COVID. And let's face it, you know, these variants didn't come from Manitoba. The variants came from Brazil, South Africa, the UK, maybe some of them from India. They didn't swim here. If they arrive that way, the most logical thing most people are going to say is, well, then stop it, shut it down. And politically, it was a no-brainer.
And it will be shut down, what, for a month? Strategists, stay there. I've got to take a quick break. But coming up, the government unveiled a whopping $100 billion, that's billion dollars, in stimulus spending this week. But is all that spending necessary, or is there some pre-election vote shopping in there? Our strategists return to dig in. Don't go away. And welcome back. The federal government tabled its first pandemic budget earlier this week and took the opportunity to announce a $100 billion stimulus program. Even a budget this big can't please everyone. So what could our strategists do differently? Let's bring them back. Greg McCachran is back, Adrian Batra as well, Anne McGrath, and Greg Weston. I remember, Greg, when we talked about the budget before the budget, you said everything and the kitchen sink, or but the kitchen sink, I don't remember. But indeed, there is the kitchen sink in there as well. So let me ask you, Weston, is this an election budget? That's an easy question.
Boy, there's a softball lob. Yes, it is. It's actually closer to an election platform than a budget. It's an election platform with numbers attached to it, basically. It really was the kitchen sink budget. There's something for everybody in there, and even when you look at things like childcare. The government has opened the door that it can campaign on that now. We're assuming probably with a fall election, it's going to take a long time past the fall for the government to try to negotiate individual deals with each of the provinces on something like childcare. So they get a great advantage out of it. They get the advantage of being able to announce it now, run on childcare, their package during the election campaign without ever having to implement it or pay for it.
Greg McCachran, what do you think about that?
Joyce, I think I can quote you and say that every budget is a political document. I think you said that a couple of weeks ago. So I'll throw your comments right back at you and agree, because during a minority government, the government in power has to be prepared to go to an election at any time. And your budget does end up being your platform. But what I think is a bit interesting on this is that the day after the budget, the first two questions in question period were not around the budget. They were around vaccines. I don't hear a lot of anger from the opposition parties. There's nothing around. There's things that they criticize, absolutely. But there's nothing that they are really, really bent out of shape for. And I think that means that this budget probably reflected the Canadian mood about what was needed more so than being a really, strong, poke the opposition in the eye kind of political document.
Anne McGrath, I know that Jagmeet Singh, there were some things he wanted. I'm thinking PharmaCare was one of the big ticket items that he, was pushing for. I also know that he said that he will vote with the government so this government doesn't fall, not pushing the country into an election. It's not the right time. When do you think will be the time for PharmaCare, when the provinces actually are asking for an increase in healthcare transfers, which was not in that budget?
Well, that's right. I mean, Jagmeet Singh has been very clear for some time now that he is not intending to provoke an election. And so it's not a surprise that he has said that. I think that there is quite a bit of disappointment about the lack of PharmaCare in there. And certainly we've been very supportive of increases to the healthcare transfers. So those things are not there, and they should be there, especially in the context of the kind of money that we're talking about in that budget. Why not have those two incredibly essential things in there is a mystery to me. There are things that we're very happy about. Obviously, as somebody who has advocated and heard promises about childcare for more than four decades now and run campaigns on it, I am so hopeful that the childcare provisions in this budget actually come to pass. I really hope that they move as quickly as possible to get those things in place and to find ways to lock them in so that they can't be dismantled, whether it's through provincial negotiations or those kinds of things. So lots
or a confidence vote
budget, but some things are not there that should be there.
Adrian, Erin O'Toole, the Conservative leader, said that he didn't like this budget. I think that the continuing of those emergency programs was important. We know that this is not the end of lockups. What do you think should have been in that budget, or what should have been taken out of that budget? Is $110 billion stimulus, when indeed the economy actually is coming back? Was that too much money, not enough money? What do you think about it?
Well, it's a whole lot of money, and the bill is going to come due eventually. But, the whole idea of the opposition coming out and asking about the vaccines versus the budget, it takes a bit of time for those big dollars to, for Canadians to, you know, digest that. But right now, what they're asking about are vaccines. Where is theirs? When is their turn? So that was you know, part of the strategy there, from what I could see. But realistically, this is unequivocally a campaign platform. And this is, you know, I'm going to be the boring one this time, Joyce, and agree with what Greg Weston had to say. And you know, this is their long-term strategy, their slow burn, in order to say, we are going to roll out all these programs and packages. But as has already been alluded to, the devil is always in the details. They need to work out these programs with the provinces and the municipalities, who will ultimately be responsible for distributing the programs and administering them. And good luck getting so many of them to agree. And that where is going to where and lie the challenge, if any of these big programs are to be implemented.
Okay, well, I have 1 minute. I'd like to go around. 1 minute, guys. And I'd like to know, do you think childcare finally, because I remember Anne last week saying her kid was 5 when they talked about it. Her kid is now 35. So, you know, a little less conversation, a little more action. McEachran, I'm going to start with you. Yes or no, will we see childcare?
We had childcare in 2006. It was replaced by the Conservatives, who gave us $100 a month.
Yes or no?
We've had it before. We can have it again. Ken Dryden negotiated deals across the country.
Anne
McGrath, yes or no?
We are completely ready to work with the Liberal government to bring in childcare.
Greg Weston.
Eventually, there will be some.
Will we have it this time? Adrian, we have 5 seconds.
Maybe-ish.
That's it for our strategist. You guys are great. This is your Power Play Day in politics. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back right here on Monday. Have a safe and happy weekend.